DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, protecting the world's food supply from desertification.
With a global population that is growing, we have to double our food production very soon. The question is, how can we do that if we are actually degrading and destroying the very land on which we depend on right now?
More rights for Kenya's women farmers means better food security.
Since they don't own the land, the women cannot join farming cooperatives, so they don't get into contact with people who can help them improve production or sales.
And Spanish scientists ask if improving air quality means fewer hospitalizations.
People may not fall over and die in the street from air pollution, but it can be the last link in the chain.
I'm Saroja Coelho. Welcome to the show. We start this week in the desert. Now try to imagine one. A desert or a dry scrubland is a place that receives less than 250 millimeters of rainfall a year. Now, changing weather patterns and intensive land use are causing the world's deserts to expand. Today, almost a third of the Earth's surface has been desertified. We're going to find out what that means later on. This week, experts from around the world are gathered here in Bonn, Germany, to discuss solutions. I'm joined in studio now by Wagaki Mwangi. She is the Public Information and Media Officer from the UNCCD Secretariat. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Before we get into the reason that all these people are gathered here in Bonn, what I'd like to ask you is, what is desertification?
It's good that we start there, because one of the challenges that we have as a convention is explaining what desertification is. The word desertification is linked to deserts, so most people think it's actually about deserts. It's not. When we talk about desertification, it simply means land degradation in the arid, semi-arid, and dry subhumid areas. That does not include deserts. Deserts are considered to be hyper-arid. So we're looking at an area where you can actually farm, you can do pastoralism, not in the desert, but on the margins of the deserts. It's the area really between the high productive areas, the humid areas, and the deserts themselves. That's the area we're looking at.
But what is the problem then with desertification? Why is that something I should be worried about?
The issue is that when you think about agriculture and where we get our food from, whether that is meat, whether that is barley or wheat, 44% of all the cultivated systems in the world are in these dry land areas, because agriculture and food production has been done in the past by cutting down forests. We cannot continue to do that. So what most people do is we then move into the areas that are marginal, productive, but marginal. And this is where you find 50% of the world's livestock, so and wildlife. So if you're thinking meat production for the world, this is the place. So it matters to the global community if these areas, which are very, very fragile soils, are farmed or are overgrazed to the point where they can no longer produce food for the global community. So what that means is when human beings, because of this climate change happening, so there are all these natural systems or events, weather events happening, floods. If you leave the ground uncovered, you erode the soil, whether it's through dust, you know, wind blowing or water running, or when there are droughts and plants cannot grow, we create these conditions that tend to be desert-like. So it's called desertification because it's man-made deserts, really. They're not natural deserts, they're man-made deserts. And they come about because of overgrazing, because of over-farming, because of not replacing the nutrients in the soil, because these are fragile soils after all. So the point is, with a global population that is growing, we have to double our food production very soon. The question is, how can we do that if we are actually degrading and destroying the very land on which we depend on right now? Either we go to the forests and clear more, which we cannot afford, or we have to manage our land better.
I'd be interested, I mean, you've traveled, you've seen some of these places. Could you give me an example of a place in the world where desertification is an issue? What does it look like? What's happening there?
So let me give you an example. An old king of Mongolia called Genghis Khan. Do you remember that story? Well, last year I had the opportunity to travel to his home area in Inner Mongolia in China. This is an area where if you look at the history of the land, it's amazing because it was green, it was lush, it was, you know, grassland area if you wish. Today, it's a complete desert. It's a man-made desert. And what happened is because of the farming systems, agricultural system, land was so overused over time, over, you know, thousands of centuries, that now it's a desert. So what is happening is that the Chinese government is trying to rehabilitate the land because it's still productive. The water still seeps into the ground. There's still rainfall, but you have to treat it. So I visited this area, and what amazed me is that they are, every year in this particular region, they are rehabilitating 32,000 hectares of land. That's all they can manage to do.
So what you're telling us is it is possible for us to come back from this situation. And that actually leads me to my next question, which is about why all these experts have gathered here from around the world to discuss solutions. So I guess they're talking about situations like that. What can farmers do on the ground? What I'm really interested in is what other kinds of ideas have been tabled?
One meeting last week was the scientists were gathered here to talk about what does it cost us? Is it worth investing in our land now to restore areas that are degraded or degrading? Or is it, should we invest that in food production now and then worry about land degradation later? One of the things that they found out by failing to take care of that land, it is costing us between 3 to 5% of the agricultural gross domestic product of the world. 3 to 5%, which is quite a substantial amount. In some countries, like Guatemala, it goes up to about 24%. Their conclusion is, we better do it now. Because if we do not start doing it now, we're just delaying a problem.
Are you getting the kind of support that you need?
Well, you know, those are scientists. So this week we have governments meeting to consider, now should we do this? Right? So the issue now is to how to bring the scientists together and the policymakers together in order to find a solution.
Now, if I live in a place with plenty of water, right, plenty of fertile land, why should I take an interest in desertification?
The demand for food, the demand for water, the demand for biofuels is growing. And for those people who are living in areas with productive land, it may not be a problem right now. But sooner or later, if we degrade all the dry lands, we're going to only depend on the high productive areas. If we only depend on the land that is currently productive, we cannot feed the world. We simply cannot do it. And agriculture, let's just talk about agriculture and the production in these high areas. Agriculture is taking about 70% of our water, freshwater resources from the ground. Because as people consume more, we're having to irrigate to meet the global demand. That has a further impact on the degradation of even highly fertile land because it gets salinized, it gets toxic. So the people living in highly productive areas can ride the wave for the moment, but 10, 15 years down the road, the pressure on them to produce will be so high that we'll be degrading even that land. What that means in the end is that we're going to have to degrade new land, cut down forests in order to meet demand. So what really the logic we're seeing is degrade, abandon, migrate. We call it the dumb. We cannot live like that. The more you produce, the more soil is eroded, you're going to have to migrate.
Wagaki Mwangi is the Public Information and Media Officer from the UNCCD Secretariat. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Our next story here on Living Planet takes us to Kenya, where women make up 80% of the country's farmers. But while women farmers may be working the land, they don't own it. Traditionally, land in Kenya was passed from father to son or brother to brother, but women were not permitted to inherit or buy it. But about 3 years ago, Kenyan women gained the right to own land. Our reporter, Andrew Wasike, went to the countryside to find out what this means for the country's farmers and for food security in Kenya.
Linda O'Carl is working in a vegetable garden as I enter her farm. I pass the poultry yard. I see she also has healthy cows which graze just a few meters away from her home. Linda disappears into the house for a moment to wash her hands and then sits down on the veranda to tell me about her life.
I started farming when my husband moved to town to look for a collar job. I was left behind and I had to take care of the children and the farm. So that's why I became a farmer. And mostly, women are at home. Men do go for jobs in town. So we are the people who have to take care of the children and the animals.
Linda O'Carl grows maize and fruit trees, rears dairy cows and many chickens, and she takes care of her two children. This is an increasingly common story in Kenya, where more and more women are taking over farms.
Mostly, women used to remain at home to take care of the family, to wash the children, to cook for the men who were always at the farm. So mostly women used to work at home. There were no women farmers before.
But now, more than 80% of Kenya's farms are run by women. Only half these women actually own their farms. The others work land that belongs to their husbands. Not having ownership creates a lot of problems for the country's female farmers. Since they don't own the land, the women cannot join farming cooperatives. So they don't get into contact with people who can help them improve production or sales. Linda O'Carl explains that they also can't get any credit from the bank to improve their equipment or hire help.
Finance is a major problem, because we don't have access to loans. Most of the farms belong to our husbands. They are the people who are owning the title deeds. A bank cannot give you a loan if you don't have your own title deed. So we are not able to have money for our farming. So mostly we don't do it in large scale. We do it in small scale.
Woboba Kiprotich works at the Kenya Ministry of Agriculture and is particularly interested in the plight of the country's women farmers.
These women, they're not financially stable, so they cannot afford the raw material and finance the land. And for them to get a title, in Kenya, you need to have, and for them to get a loan, they need to have a title deed or a stable income, which they don't have, thus denying them the privilege of getting the loans which could have helped them to finance their farms for better productivity and upkeep.
In 2010, Kenya drafted a new constitution guaranteeing equal rights for women. As part of this, they can now inherit property and own land. But in Kenya's rural areas, many people still don't know about the new constitution. So whole communities live under the old system, a system that disadvantages women and girls, particularly in property rights. Owning land gives women access to capital. It also gives them the freedom to live abusive marriages, the ability to contribute to the economy.
By supporting women farmers, this will lead to the improvement of infrastructure, reduce trade barriers, and with this taken care of, there won't be rural to urban migration in search of things like processing factories, employments, and better standards of living. This will discourage rural to urban migration, thus many women will be encouraged into farming. With the high number of women farming, you are sure of food security in the country because of the labor.
According to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, Kenyan farms managed by men are still 8% more productive than farms run by women. But the numbers are misleading. The women have fewer resources, fewer machines, and outdated irrigation systems. In fact, the UN says that if they had credit and they were able to invest in new equipment, the farms run by women would be the most productive in Kenyan history. Kiprotich says the government is ready to make that happen.
We are building roads to facilitate easy transport for the farm product. We have also built dams for irrigation scheme and provision of electricity. We are educating women on use of modern technology through mechanization. We are also trying our best to provide for them readily available market for their product.
Government support is changing the lives of farmers like Linda Okal, who is dreaming about the future of her farm.
I doubt my husband will refuse because I have developed this place so much. And it's like I actually own it. He will be surprised, but I doubt that he will refuse.
And she says she's not planning to ever leave her land.
My hope for the future is that our rural areas to be developed so that people don't have to live for work in the city. Also, I would love to see women's rights guaranteed as was done by the new constitution.
Thank you to Andrew Wasike for that report. We have a special story now from Angola. It's about oil, and it comes to us from our sister show, Africa Link. Angola has vast oil reserves lying beneath the sea off the northern coast. This oil has been extracted over the past few decades, turning Angola into Africa's second biggest oil producer. But if the country is pumping out so much oil at a time when the world market is hungry for it, why is 40% of Angola's population still living on less than $1 a day? Sela Onico presents this report by DW's Renata Krieger. Renata spent a week in Angola, starting in the northern town of Soyo on the border of the Democratic Republic of Congo.
With his car key, taxi driver Luciano Nzomba Madia scrapes three circles next to each other in the red sand. He adds some lines and slowly an abstract map appears.
Aqui é Cabinda. Aqui é Soyo.
This is Cabinda. This is Soyo. And there is Luanda, the capital. The pipelines from Luanda and Cabinda meet here in Soyo.
Luciano explains that huge pipes run out into the sea from Soyo. They're intended to extract natural gas from a depth of up to 1,700 meters. Luciano is a trained electrician and was employed as a supervisor for the LNG, the Liquefied Natural Gas Project, between 2010 and 2011. According to the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, Angola is second only to Nigeria in the list of Africa's biggest oil exporters. It is also believed to have more than 366 billion cubic meters of natural gas reserves. We drive to Soyo, to Angola's first LNG plant. In 2000, work began on building a complex network of pipelines covering an area the size of 240 football pitches. International energy giant Chevron holds a majority stake in the operating company Angola LNG. The plan was for the Soyo plant to begin operating in early 2012, making Angola one of Africa's first exporters of liquefied natural gas. But there's been a long delay. The official explanation is that the plant is still in its test phase. Visits are rarely approved. DW was not allowed in. Pipes running along the roadside spit out flames a meter high as poisonous gases are flared off. At night, they often provide the only light as street lamps rarely function, says Luciano. He had hoped the natural resources boom would be good for him and his family. But when the laying of the pipelines was completed, he lost his job. But Luciano didn't sit around and mope. He now earns up to $150 a day as a taxi driver. As an LNG supervisor, he earned just $330 a month. He no longer believes in what the politicians say.
They say when Angola LNG is operating, that's good for Angola. But it's always others who benefit. Many Angolans have left the country.
It's a different scene in the capital, Luanda, home to 5 million people. Luxury cars drive along the smooth Avenida Marginal, a symbol of the new prosperity. The government has used some of the oil money to improve the road network, but many side streets are still marred with potholes and non-functioning traffic lights. Elias Isaac heads the human rights organization Open Society Angola. He he says the majority of Angolans are not profiting from the oil revenues.
As estatísticas apontam que o setor petrolífero em Angola só representa 0.5%.
Statistics say only 1.5% of Angola's active workforce are employed in the oil sector. There's a big contradiction here. We have economic growth, but we are only really collecting capital and building new roads, which was very necessary after the civil war. But this doesn't improve the standard of living for people who have no access to electricity, drinking water or sanitation facilities.
According to a report issued last year by the United Nations, 37% of the population live in extreme poverty, on less than $1 a day. That's at least an improvement on the figure of 54% in the year 2000. But when compared to the country's economic growth, it's only modest. The GDP increased eightfold between 2000 and 2011, says the World Bank. While the poor have gained little, the rich have grown even richer. Norbert Garcia is a member of the ruling MPLA party. He says education is the key to closing the gap.
The best way to distribute national wealth is by creating jobs. But we have a difficult situation here with a high rate of illiteracy. The government must improve education so that more people can get jobs.
The government is planning to step up the fight against hunger and poverty with a national development plan that will also improve access to energy and water. This would be welcomed by the many people still living in slum conditions. For example, in Luanda's crowded Kazenga district, or in nearby Vienna, where newly built apartment blocks stand empty as no one can afford to pay the rent. Many live in ramshackle huts. Their previous homes were demolished to make way for a new road. Back in Soyo, Luciano is concerned about the country's future.
If the oil runs out, then we'll have nothing. The only wealth we have is oil and diamonds.
Experts predict that Angola's oil reserves will only last for another 20 or 30 years.
Thank you to DW's Renata Krieger for that report. She spent a week in Angola in the northern town of Soyo. The English version was read by Sela Oneko. Our last report in today's edition of Living Planet takes us to the Spanish capital, Madrid. Now, Spanish researchers are attempting to show that air pollution contributes to problems including lung and heart conditions. Their results could have consequences for Spain's entire air pollution strategy. Lucas Larson has more.
You don't have to step into the street from Madrid's roads to pose a hazard to your health. That's because the air pollution from cars in the city is so dangerous. It's not quite a top 10 killer. In Western Europe, lifestyle choices such as tobacco smoking, lack of exercise, and unhealthy food pose a bigger risk. Still, high on the list of sources of disease is something beyond any individual's control: particulate air pollution. In Madrid, 3/4 of air pollution comes from motor vehicles. On bad days, a brown cloud sits on top of the city. Residents have taken to calling the smog cloud the boina, or beret, because it looks like the city is wearing a cap. More objective measures of the city's air pollution show that it regularly exceeds European-mandated levels of gases and particles. I asked madrileños, or Madrid residents, walking around Atocha, one of the city's biggest roundabouts, what they thought authorities should do about pollution.
We need to reduce traffic and make cars that use other fuels.
Promote riding bicycles and using public transport more. I think there should be a fee, too, for cars that enter certain zones.
According to studies by Julio Diaz, a researcher at the Carlos III Health Institute in Madrid, even small increases in air pollution can cause the number of people admitted to hospitals with circulatory and respiratory illnesses to rise.
People may not fall over and die in the street from air pollution, but it can be the last link in the chain.
It's tricky, or maybe even impossible, to blame any one death or hospital visit on air pollution, so researchers are investigating various types of pollution and looking for links to the whole population's health. Begoña Artiñeño and her colleagues at Madrid's Center for Energy, Environmental and Technological Research are at the forefront of developing these new measuring techniques.
Antiguamente se legislaban las partículas totales en suspensión en el aire.
We used to look at total suspended particulate matter in the air. Then we realized that the effect of the particles was closely related to their size.
De las partículas están muy ligados a su tamaño.
That may sound kind of technical, and it is. What Artiñeño means is that Spain's pollution monitoring stations track two sizes of particles along with gases such as sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, and ozone. They also track persistent organic pollutants and suspended heavy metal particles. Measuring in this differentiated way helps public health researchers identify relationships between specific pollutants and diseases.
Pero ahora se está viendo otro tipo de efectos. Están saliendo publicaciones sobre efectos.
The principal at-risk groups are people with respiratory ailments, such as asthma, for example. But now we're seeing other types of effects. For example, in the case of larger particles, there are pollutants that are carcinogenic. There are pollutants that produce effects such as lower birth weights in babies.
En el peso de los niños al nacer.
A recent study by another research group at the Carlos III Health Institute found that people living within 5 kilometers of incinerators and junkyards, which emit arsenic and chromium, among other things, have an around 6% higher chance of dying due to certain cancers than people who live further away. Globally, air pollution shortens lives by an average of 8.6 months, according to the World Health Organization, with people primarily affected by cardiovascular and respiratory diseases and lung cancer.
Other cities in Europe have chosen to institute some different anti-pollution policies, and some of them have been the same as in Madrid, like low emissions zones, a fee for entering the city center, or only allowing certain types of vehicles in certain zones, promoting, for example, bicycle use.
El fomento del uso de la bicicleta.
Madrid has succeeded in reducing its sulfur dioxide levels, for example, by promoting natural gas heating as a replacement for coal. But it's also taken shortcuts. In 2010, Madrid officials moved some of its air monitoring stations from traffic-choked streets to quieter parts of the city, like this park. A handful of instruments perch on the roof of a fenced-in, dark green metal box about the size of a delivery truck. Pollution numbers dropped, but now researchers can't compare the new data to the old. Some people accused the government of fixing the data instead of the pollution problem. If that's true, they didn't do a very good job. The city's own measurements show that they still regularly exceed European recommendations for nitrogen dioxide levels. But the city can use the data generated by its stations to evaluate the air quality plan it enacted last year. It calls for low-emission zones in the city and the promotion of electric cars, public transport, and bicycle use. And some of that is happening. At the Puerta del Sol, Madrid's symbolic heart, bright red paint marks a new crosstown bicycle lane. But most of the time, it is empty, while rows of honking traffic idle beside it, as one resident complains.
This isn't getting fixed. There are too many cars.
Mucho coche.
In the hope that the pollution will go down, madrileños can cross their fingers, but they can't hold their breath. This is Lucas Lauerson in Madrid for DW.
Yes. Blackness. The black side of me. Come on.
And that's it for this edition of Living Planet. Thank you for tuning in. I'll be back again next week when Living Planet goes nuclear. We're going to be covering energy. We're going to be talking about the policies attached to energy solutions. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at DW_eco. I'm Saroja Coelho. Thanks for listening.
Stress my mind, I realize that we ain't suffering, 'cause we made the rules in which we're living in today. It's so good, 'cause there's one who sees your effort, one who is aware of how much you sacrifice, how many tears you cry, take heart.
We eat our things, we come in ourselves, ain't much patience, in tribulation, in need.